This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 7th of September. Our main stories: rescue teams in the Bahamas are picking through the debris in search of victims of Hurricane Dorian. India has lost contact with its lunar lander just as it was about to touch down on the surface of the moon. And health authorities in the US are urging people to stop vaping after a third death linked to e-cigarettes. Also in this podcast:
I've never considered changing my name, because if you do that, people will inevitably ask, what was your original name? You'll say it was Nigel, and they'll consider you to be a Nigel as a noun, and that's never a good thing.
Why the UK is suffering a shortage of Nigels. Hurricane Dorian is now moving away from North Carolina after briefly making landfall, but it caused relatively little damage on the US coast compared to the almost complete destruction seen in parts of the Bahamas where it hit 6 days ago. 30 people are known to have died there, but the World Health Organization says it's extremely concerned about the final death toll. Dr. Ian Norton manages the WHO's emergency medical teams.
We certainly expect the death toll to rise. I can't tell you what that will be, but we're really worried about it. And what we've seen, unfortunately, this devastating storm surge, especially with a stationary storm, produces what you could see maybe after a tsunami. And what we don't see in those cases is injuries as such. We see, unfortunately, a lot of people drowned and losing their lives or surviving.
Hundreds of people remain missing on the Abaco Islands, which were hit by winds of 295 kilometres an hour and a huge storm surge. A woman in the settlement of Marsh Harbour said the smell of decomposing bodies was everywhere. My colleague Paul Henley spoke to David Begno, a reporter for CBS, who's just come back from the Abaco Islands.
The best opportunity we had to hear from survivors was on a flight that we took with Chef Jose Andres to the area, two different areas. One was Green Turtle Cay and the other was Treasure Cay. The first place we landed was Green Turtle Cay. And as they were offloading equipment, I went up to a group of people who were standing right near the helicopter and I said, "What do you need?" And the first thing a woman yelled was, "Homes." Notably, no one was angry or seemingly bitter as you might expect they would be after several days in the blazing hot sun with homes that were either badly damaged or destroyed. I didn't see one home in this community of roughly 550 people that was untouched. Nearly all of them were destroyed. And one woman said to me, "It's like going back 25 years, no cell phone service, just, you know, kind of completely cut off." One woman walked up and she put her hands in the air and she said, "Thank God we're okay. Nobody died, but we need all the help we can get. Food, water, fuel, generators, whatever." But then she said, "We are so thankful." And it reminds me, I've been in a lot of disaster zones, but it's really bad here. When we got to Treasure Cay, a volunteer fireman walked up to us and he said, "It is deplorable. There are safety concerns. There are reports that have been confirmed by the Prime Minister regarding looting." And one thing that's interesting is when you listen to the government, they are sort of well-spoken and articulate and very measured in letting you know that they are handling things. But when you talk to the people who are in the devastated areas, that is not the story they're telling, saying, reading. They don't agree with that. They're like, "We haven't seen a government official." In, you know, Treasure Cay, they were like, "Where are the police? Where's the military?" And I asked the defense minister today, "Do you have anybody in Treasure Cay?" And he said, "Oh, we have people there. You just haven't seen them."
Tell me more about what you did see.
What I saw was bare, naked trees that had been stripped of any foliage. Homes that were either leveled or totally destroyed, blown like popsicle sticks. What I saw was people sitting in the middle of the street. I saw a mother and her three children sitting on the roof of a building that had been blown off and was on the ground. They were sitting on the roof, which was on the ground, and she was hoping to get a seat on a private plane out of Treasure Cay.
CBS reporter David Begno. Our correspondent, Aline McBall, is on board a rescue vessel in the Bahamas.
This British ship, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary Mounts Bay, was in the area to provide emergency assistance in just this type of scenario. We've already seen it deliver shelter and ration kits to some parts of the Bahamas, but I'm now watching heavy lifting vehicles and equipment being loaded onto a small vessel to help another island. Captain Rob Anders told me the ship had actually been following the storm so it could help in one area while other places close by were still being hit by the hurricane.
We're pretty much the first people at the sea in a lot of cases. We're delivering aid to areas which have been cut off, especially away from the main island of Great Abaco. There's smaller islands outskirts where communications have gone. This whole area has been wiped out. The Haitian village to the north of Great Abaco doesn't exist anymore, and that had quite a large diaspora. So the response that we're providing, the UK government is providing with DFID, is vital in this case.
The needs are great, and new areas are still being reached all the time, with new horrors left behind by the hurricane being revealed.
Aleem Makbul on a British Navy vessel in the Bahamas. India was hoping to become only the fourth nation after the US, Russia and China to land a spacecraft on the moon. But there are fears that its Vikram lander has instead suffered the same fate as an Israeli mission, which crash-landed on the lunar surface in April. The Indian Space Agency said communication had been lost with the lander, which had been sent to the unexplored south pole of the moon. Until that moment, commentary on Indian television suggested things were progressing as planned.
Maybe in another few seconds, we should hear the announcement that the fine-breaking phase of operation has been completed. And we expect at the end of this, the vehicle to reach at an altitude of almost 400 meters. And the velocity right now, if you look at the plot, we have the Vikram lander has a horizontal velocity of nearly 48 meters and vertical velocity of 60 meters per second.
And then there were long pauses in the commentary and silence among the scientists waiting at mission control in Bangalore. A short time later, a spokesman at Indian Space Control had this to say.
Vikram lander descent was as planned and normal performance was observed up to an altitude of 2.1 kilometer. Subsequently, the communications from the lander to ground station was lost. The data is being analyzed.
Raji Raja Gopalan is head of the Nuclear and Space Policy Initiative at the Observer Research Foundation in India.
I think it's too early to say with any certainty as to what could have possibly gone wrong. Till the last minute, you got it right. But I think this was going to be a complex mission for ISRO. Even China, that has developed certain sophisticated capabilities, its first landing mission on the moon was on the near side of the moon. So landing on the southern polar region or far side, those are much more complex mission. And it is ISRO has not, the Indian Space Research Organization, has not really come out with a statement as to what could have possibly gone wrong. There are a couple of different things one could see. One is the engine at the center that was supposed to come on. Maybe that malfunctioned and that did not come on. That's a possibility. Second, to give it a positive spin, is that maybe the lander, the rover and the lander has landed actually perfectly fine. Maybe you just lost the transmission, data transmission link, and that maybe that's a positive way to look at it. But I think given the complexity of the mission and the overall success rates so far of various missions that various different countries have tried, it's been just about 50%. So this is going to be a difficult one. But having said that, I think I'll just add this one point, which is that I think you still have something really impressive with this mission, which is the orbiter. The orbiter is still functioning without any glitches, and that's going to be around for one full year, and which means that the orbiter will be able to continue sending messages, the info data, as well as be able to take message, imagery, for instance. So I think there is still quite a bit of advanced benefits that you see from this mission, but of course the mission as planned has not gone that well, in a sense, of course.
Raji Raja Gopalan and the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who travelled to the Bangalore Space Centre to watch the landing, told scientists there they had already made significant achievements and the whole nation was proud. The Liberator, who won Zimbabwe its independence and brought education to the black population, or the Dictator, who ordered the massacre of thousands of opposition supporters and then trashed the economy. Robert Mugabe has been remembered for both the good and ill he did Zimbabwe during his 37-year rule. He died aged 95 in hospital in Singapore, 2 years after he'd been overthrown by a military which had finally had enough of his despotism. President Emmerson Mnangagwa, his former deputy who turned against him, declared Mr. Mugabe a national hero.
Comrade Robert Gabe Mugabe leaves a big void in our nation. A veteran nationalist and a doughty pan-Africanist fighter, Comrade Mugabe bequeaths a rich and indelible legacy of tenacious adherence to principle on the collective rights of Africa and Africans in general, and in particular, the rights of the people of Zimbabwe, for whom he gave his all to help free.
Well, our correspondent Shingai Nyoka spent the day on the streets of Harare.
Many people are reflecting on his legacy. President Emmerson Mnangagwa has in fact declared days of mourning until his remains arrive back in Zimbabwe and are buried. So I've been speaking to many Zimbabweans who've been reflecting about his legacy, and this is what they had to say.
This man caused untold suffering for a long time, and that system is still oppressing us today. We achieved nothing when he left. We are harassed here, and this is something he created.
He was one of the liberators. Like myself, he was my first president. So to me, he deserves a great honor as well.
And so these are some of the comments that we've been hearing on the streets, confirming just how conflicted Zimbabweans are when it comes to President Robert Mugabe's legacy. And one of his key critics was a member of the opposition, Tendai Biti. He was a former finance minister, but served in a coalition government with Robert Mugabe. And previously, he referred to him as a dictator. But this is what he had to say about former President Robert Mugabe.
Robert Mugabe was the product of a certain era, an era that confronted the colonial regime, powder for powder, blow for blow. So violence came naturally to him. So his legacy shouldn't be detracted by the fact that there were atrocities, commissions and omissions committed. I think today we must mourn Robert Mugabe and pass condolences to his wife and his children, and thank him for leading the battle against colonialism and for the emancipation of Zimbabwe, leading to its independence on the 18th of April 1980. I was tortured by Robert Mugabe in 2008. Many Zimbabweans were killed during Gukurahundi, but I think that I don't feel bitterness. I feel indebtedness. I feel a gratitude to the work he did in liberating our country.
And so there you hear former President Robert Mugabe had his admirers, but he also had his critics. And I'm sure there'll be many more discussions in the days ahead about what exactly his impact was on Zimbabwe.
Shingai Nyoka in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. A third person has died in the US from a severe lung disease apparently caused by vaping. The death happened in Indiana. The other two were in the states of Oregon and Illinois in July and August. The outbreak has left hundreds of people ill and several teenagers in induced comas. One possible cause may be black market e-cigarettes. I asked our Washington correspondent David Willis for more details.
Well, in addition to these deaths, Oliver, officials have identified, they say, more than 450 cases of severe lung illness across 33 states, which they believe are linked to vaping. They say that what begins as a chest pain and shortage of breath often leads to coughing, vomiting and a lung infection that is said to be similar to pneumonia, leading some people to being placed on ventilators, placed in medically induced comas, or worse than that. So officials have again urged people to stop vaping until they work out what is causing these illnesses.
Yeah, and in particular, a lot of young people have fallen ill. Do they think it's something wrong with a particular batch, perhaps?
Well, what is puzzling about this is that no one single factor seems common to every case of illness. No single device, no liquid, no ingredient. But that said, they are looking, these health officials, very closely at the chemical THC. Now, that's used to give marijuana its high, and it can be bought off the street, and that's the possible danger here, it's thought. There is also an ingredient called vitamin E acetate, which is sometimes used to thicken marijuana vape juice. That's known to be dangerous if heated and inhaled. But because there's a lack of a common thread here, doctors and health officials continue to suggest that people just stay away from all vaping products until they manage to find out what's actually causing these illnesses.
David Willis in Washington. And before we move on, a quick reminder about another of our podcasts, In the Studio. It takes you into the minds of the world's most creative people. So if you want to hear artists, writers, sports stars, musicians and DJs reflect on what goes on behind the scenes, then search for In the Studio from the BBC World Service wherever you get your podcasts. 8 US states and the District of Columbia have launched an antitrust investigation into Facebook to determine if the social media giant has stifled competition and put users at risk. Samira Hussain reports from New York.
The investigation into Facebook's behavior is being led by New York State Attorney General Letitia James. In a statement, she said even the largest social media platform in the world must follow the law and respect consumers. Facebook has been recently fined $5 billion by a top U.S. regulator for failing to protect user data. Additionally, the company remains under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice. Facebook says it will work constructively with state officials.
Samira Hussain. Opposition parties in Britain have agreed to work together to reject Prime Minister Boris Johnson's call for a snap election before an EU summit in mid-October. Mr. Johnson's minority government is planning a vote in Parliament on Monday, but it needs the backing of two-thirds of MPs. An election is widely seen as the way to break the deadlock over Brexit, but Mr. Johnson's opponents will only agree to one once they're sure the Prime Minister will not be able to take Britain out of the EU without a deal on the 31st of October. This week was Boris Johnson's first test in the House of Commons since he won the vote to succeed Theresa May as Prime Minister. Our deputy political editor, John Pienaar, considers where it's left him and how Mr. Johnson might move forward.
As good weeks go, for Boris Johnson, this wasn't one. Defeated and defeated again in the Commons, choosing to sack over 20 of his most respected colleagues for staging a rebellion, facing uproar from Tories who say that was brutally heavy-handed and now trying to sound conciliatory. Today, the Lords sent legislation to ban no deal, which could also force the PM to seek a Brexit extension to become law. He won't break his word. Civil servants are clear he can't break the law. Mr. Johnson needs a way to force an election or salvage his plan to deliver Brexit at the end of October, maybe without getting an EU deal first. In Downing Street, there's no sign they've found one. The options on Number 10's table after another expected defeat on election timing next week range from quitting office in the hope of getting back in to counting on the EU to deny Britain the Brexit extension the PM doesn't want. If there's a cunning plan and many people in and out of government don't believe there is, it seems to need more work, and soon.
John Pienaar. Technology, which allows us to manipulate things just by the power of thought, is advancing like never before. EEG, or electroencephalography, allows users to control video games, machines, or even cars, just with the power of their minds. But as the BBC's Ed Butler has been exploring, the possibilities are matched by the dangers.
No point in shooting him. So, as you can see, if I wink, I can actually kill people if they went front.
The sound there of mind-manipulated killing in a video game. Commercially available EEG monitors are these days a mainstream part of video gaming, thinking your way to murder, mayhem and fast car driving by means of a headset costing a few hundred dollars. The kit here has been developed by a firm called Emotive. And as well as gaming, it's collecting the brain data of its 100,000 users in 120 countries to hone and refine its applications. It's all primarily in the interests of science, according to the company's president, Olivier Houllier.
The headsets allow for people to control things with their minds, meaning that if you're a gamer, you can control your character in a game with your mind and it frees up your hands to do something. Similarly, people who are disabled, who lost the use of their limbs, can control their wheelchair with our minds.
How close are we to that holy grail of actual mind reading?
If you're thinking about being able to decrypt whether I'm thinking about a carrot at the moment or a race car, we're very far from there.
Olivier Houllier, president of the bioinformatics and technology firm Emotive. The tech may yet be primitive, but the potential for misuse also does seem pretty limitless. It's something that's certainly occupying Nita Farahani. She's a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University in the US, and she's specializing in the legal and ethical challenges of emerging technologies.
A lot of use of these technologies has been discussed in China, where factory employees in state-run factories or in state-run trains, where train conductors are required to wear them, the information that can be gathered from those, even if it's attention or drowsiness or cognitive decline over time, suggests that the kind of last place where there's freedom of thought or privacy is about to be breached. And I'm afraid that people are going to give up that last bastion of freedom far too easily, just as they've given up other areas of privacy. If you're unable to have freedom of thought, if you're unable to think dissident or creative or any kind of thoughts without fear of somebody listening in or some kind of harm that could come to you, discrimination or even, you know, being put in jail for having dissident thoughts, I worry that that's the direction that we're going unless we get out ahead of these technologies to try to create safeguards for individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to take a pause there and think about that one example you gave of a Chinese factory where a worker who is, I don't know, thinking idle thoughts that are nothing to do with the job and the production line they're supposed to be thinking could literally be pulled up by their manager and saying, you know, time for you to go home. You're off for the day. You're not going to get paid because your thoughts aren't in the right place.
Right.
I mean,
right.
That
it
could
feed into a social credit system. I mean, it could be far worse than just go home for the day, right?
Exactly. It has huge implications.
It does. You know, and I fear that even before we get to the point where you can decode any complex thoughts, just, you know, your waning attention, your emotional instability, your cognitive decline, things that we could pick up today with these technologies could start to be used in discriminatory ways against individuals. And people don't know what kind of information you can truly decode. So what I fear is a world in which people really start to self-censor, right? You're afraid to think freely. You're afraid to think creatively. You're afraid to think dissident thoughts or even to seek out the truth. You hear something that, you know, sounds like it couldn't possibly be accurate. Your brain might start reeling to try to discover the truth. And yet you'd be afraid to do so if your brain is being monitored at all times, which means that, you know, propaganda could start to become much more prevalent as people are afraid to test and to reject ideas.
Professor Nita Farahani at Duke University ending that report from the BBC's Ed Butler. Here in Britain, a pub landlord has organised what he hopes will be the largest gathering of people called Nigel. The publican, Nigel Smith, from the Fleece Inn in Worcestershire in central England, heard there was a shortage of Nigels after reading a government report which said virtually no babies in the country had been given that name in recent years. Richard Hamilton has been finding out what's wrong with being called Nigel.
The name Nigel is now considered so old-fashioned that publican Nigel Smith has announced there'll be a Nigel night at his pub in Bretforton. He says he wants to have a gathering of Nigels before they become extinct and to try to set a new world record.
To get the world record for the largest number of people with the same name in the same place, it's 2,300 or so, or a little bit more, which is held by the name Ivan in Bosnia-Herzegovina from 2017. So if we do that, we will have to get the place expanded a little bit and find some additional Nigel car parking, otherwise things might get a bit tricky.
In 2016, there were so few babies named Nigel that it was removed from the Office for National Statistics list, which excludes any names given to two or fewer children.
I often ask my mum why I was called Nigel.
The football commentator, Nigel Adderley, told me what it's like being called Nigel.
She said she thought it would be good I had a name which nobody else had at school. When I went to school, XTC brought out a song called Making Plans for Nigel.
We're only making plans for Nigel.
Which seemed to depict a character called Nigel as fairly hopeless. That really didn't help me. I can't think of a reason why you would call your son Nigel now unless you wanted to belittle them.
And did you ever try to change your name?
No. I believe that once I was given the name Nigel, it was a cross I had to bear. And when I speak to other Nigels, I think there's a fairly strong bond. We know it's an issue, but we've all had to deal with it. And I've never considered changing my name, because if you do that, people will inevitably ask, what was your original name? You'll say it was Nigel, and they'll consider you to be a Nigel as a noun, and that's never a good thing.
The word Nigel derives from the Irish Nile, meaning champion. It then made its way south to France and entered England at the time of the Norman conquest. Nigel Night will be held on Saturday, the 28th of September. Real Nigels will have to prove their identity. Non-Nigels are welcome to attend, but will have to wear a badge explaining that they're not Nigel.
Our own non-Nigel, Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.